Hey, this is Marshall. For longtime listeners, you kind of know the drill. For those of you just joining, I have a Patreon for this podcast at patreon.com/journeyinto. And the episode that you're going to be listening to right now was posted to the Patreon page over a month ago. And earlier today, I posted the latest episode of the Outfield Excursions, where Rish and I talk about Marnie, another Alfred Hitchcock film, this time starring Sean Connery. If you'd like to listen to that right away, you can head on over to Patreon and sign up for just $1 a month to get early episodes and extra episodes. Or you can wait around for another month or so, and that episode will eventually end up here on the main feed also. For now, join Rish and I in our discussion of The Vast of Night.
Be warned, folks, there will be spoilers.
You were entering a realm between clandestine and forgotten, a slipstream caught between channels, the secret museum of mankind, the private library of shadows, all taking place on a stage forged from mystery and found only in a frequency caught between logic and myth. You were entering Paradox Theater. Tonight's episode, The Vast of Night.
Hello there, and welcome to the Outfield Excursions here on the Journey Into podcast. I am one of your guides today on the excursion, Marshall Latham, and I'm joined, as always, by Rish Outfield.
Hey there, Marshall. I'm going to try something right here. Side stitches that shall pen thy breath up, urchins shall, forth at vast of night, that they may work all exercise on thee. Apparently that's English, and that is from Shakespeare's The Tempest. I can't make heads or tails of it, but it says forth at vast of night there, so.
Maybe that's where they drew their inspiration from.
Right, yeah, that's why I said it.
I'm Captain Obvious tonight.
That's all right. I am Lieutenant Commander Obvious, and I defer to your rank here.
So tonight, today, depending on when you're listening to this.
It's always night. Always night.
Oh, it's got to be, because the movie that we're going to be talking about tonight is called The Vast of Night, and it's a very recent movie that came out on Amazon Prime. Unfortunately, though, we've had the habit lately of watching a movie and then waiting weeks to talk about it together. How long ago did you watch this movie, Rish?
Oh, geez. 3 weeks? Maybe four?
Maybe four, yeah, because it's been at least 2 weeks, because I watched it, I guess, a week after you did. We talked about it, and then I think you watched it, and then over a weekend or something, I watched it, and I said, hey, I just watched it. I can't remember what I said, but it was I said, be careful, because it's a slow movie, and don't watch it if you're tired. And you replied back saying, too late. About a week late for that advice.
Yeah, oh, that's all right. Okay. Now, we haven't been able to get together because every Wednesday, so I have my weekends in the middle of the week, and every Wednesday I will go to the family cabin and come back Thursday night. This is the first non-cabin, non-weekend for me, and so I think we probably would have done this weeks ago if I hadn't been doing that. But I like to go to the cabin. We've talked about it before. I'm by myself. There's no internet. There's no television. So I can focus on writing and editing and recording and exercise and reading and sleep. I'll admit there's lots of, like, I will take another nap now. but I really enjoy that. I enjoy the solitude of it. There have been times when I've gone up there and not seen another living soul. I mean, unless you count animals, I'll always see deer. But that is really strange, the isolation of that. And I enjoy that. I enjoy going somewhere, and if I want to sing, I can sing. Nobody will be bothered. You know that feeling?
Yeah, yeah. It's been a while since I've done something like that, but
yeah, and when you live with other people, you have to be conscious of that, or there are times when I want to record something and somebody is watching something loudly on the TV and I can't do it. And there's a freedom to going somewhere where there's nobody. And anything I want to do, I can do. Sorry, I guess that was an excuse for why this episode is going to be so bad. I barely remember The Vast of Night. And part of it was, yes, I was tired when I watched it. It is not, you know, a Hollywood blockbuster. It's an independent film made on a very low budget. It's one of those movies that just like sort of racks up the tension by making you wait, by making you observe and
listen.
And that is great, but it's not great when you're running on fumes at the end of the day.
Yes, definitely.
And so I'm going to have to depend on you to fill in the gaps when we talk about this movie, more so than any other time when we've done this.
Well, I shall do my best.
Okay, yeah, and maybe that's going to be entertaining to people. If you're listening at home and you love to hear Rish Outfield say, "I have no memory of that," then this will be your favorite episode.
Well, I guess, but to start...
Sorry, let me ask you how you heard about this movie, because I feel like you emailed me and said, "Have you heard of this movie, Vast of Night? We should watch that for the show."
I think it was on a list of, you know, movies that had come out over the weekend or something like that. And I had seen, you know, this, and I had seen Vast of Night. And then later on, I was listening to something, a podcast, and they started talking about it, that they had seen The Vast of Night. They kind of gave the premise for it. And I thought, well, that's kind of cool. And then they said it was on Amazon Prime, because I said, oh, it's probably on HBO or, you know, some other thing that I don't get. But when they said it was on Amazon Prime, I'm like, oh, really? I'll have to check that out. And then when I got home later, I looked and I found it on there, and I put it on our watch list, and I checked the rating, and I even looked it up to see, because a lot of times we've been burned, because I kind of wanted to watch it with the whole family. And a couple times we've gotten burned by not knowing what was going to be in the show and then having to turn it off or whatever. So I did kind of do a little bit of homework to see if, you know, there was any nudity or, you know, hard cussing or anything like that. And no, there was none of that in there. So I'm like, okay, this is great. A couple of my kids said, yeah, I'll watch it. So eventually we got around to watching it, and it was kind of fun. I was glad that I wasn't just alone watching it at night when all the kids were in bed or something like that. It was kind of fun to watch it together.
So who did you watch it with?
I think it was everybody, my three kids that are at home and my wife, we all watched it.
But you didn't have to twist their arm? Or do you guys have like a set movie night every week and just, you know, you watch something together anyhow?
Yeah, we typically watch Friday nights, depending on schedules, work schedules. My oldest son works now, and then, so it's either a Friday or a Saturday that we're all watching something together. And sometimes, you know, we spend an hour just deciding what we're going to watch because nobody can agree on anything. So that's always fun. But yeah, I think everybody was on board. I think a couple of people said, "Ah, sure, whatever," and then a couple of them wanted to watch it. So. It's always interesting, though, watching it with my kids, because they like to comment and talk a lot, which I don't always appreciate. But I kind of get insight into what they're thinking and what they like about the movie. And I know at the beginning of this movie, when there's an extended scene of the two main characters just walking through town, talking to each other, and it just lingers and goes on, and after a while one of my kids is like, "This is really slow. This is going on for a long time." I said, "Well, it's a different kind of movie."
What else you got in there?
Just my mouthpiece and some hairpins.
hairpins.
Yeah, my mom says you can stash hairpins anywhere, and one day you'll be glad you did it.
Jeez, that's weird.
All right, I just read about this, and I think it's boss. So don't you make me feel like a fool for liking it.
Oh, I would never. Come on, let me have it. Razz my berries.
All right, well, did you know that there was actually an experiment done earlier this year in Lincoln, Nebraska for a radio-controlled car by RCA, like a full-size one?
Well, late dead.
Yep, it's called Electronic Highway Control. And this article says that there's a series of circuits buried in the pavements with little lats connected to them so they can communicate to the cars with radio control and take over steering and braking. It's crazy.
Oh, wait, so this is already an experiment. They already did this?
Mm-hmm. In Lincoln, Nebraska, in April, you press a button on the dash of the car that says electronic drive, and the car starts to drive itself.
Dude, that's incredible.
Yeah, I know. And get this. Well, actually, two things. First of all, it can tell if there's a car stopped up to a mile ahead, and it'll slow traffic automatically, like all cars at once, like a school of fish.
Well, your kids are right, and you tend to notice it when it's a single take. We've talked about this with Rope. We talked about it with 1917. Some of the movies where they do that, a purposely super long take, because we're used to the way that movies are edited, where you cut, and then you see another person, and you cut back, and all that. We tend to start to get uncomfortable psychologically when it doesn't cut, when it stays on somebody's face or stays on the exact same shot for a long time, because that's how real life is, but that's not how movies are. And so I can understand the kids being like, dude. And I felt that way too. I know exactly what scene you're talking about. Well, I mean, obviously, although there's lots of them walking through the town.
Yeah.
but yes, it was a, what do you call that? Where it's like a showcase kind of thing. It was the director showing off, just like a super long, extensive, elaborate take through multiple locations. And I guess we'll talk about that when we talk about the movie itself.
Yeah.
But there were multiple like super long takes in this.
Yeah, there were.
There was one where they're interviewing the older lady. And I just kept waiting for something to like jump out because I was getting more and more and more tense because the camera would not cut. It was just on this lady's face. and then there's another one earlier on where the girl is doing the switchboard and it's just a conversation that I don't know how long it goes on. I guess I'd have to watch it again to time it. But it felt like 7 or 8 minutes.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see a scene count. You know, how many scenes are actually in this movie? Because, like we're talking about that, the opening scene, I mean, it probably goes on for the first 10 minutes at least of the movie, maybe more, where there's not any kind of obviously there's cuts in there. I mean, it's the same flow of this guy walking through the school. And, well, we'll get into that, like you said, but I guess just to talk a little bit about the people that are involved with the movie, it was directed by Andrew Patterson, and it was also written by Andrew Patterson, along with Craig W. Singer. And this is like the first thing these guys have written and directed, so it's very new, like you said, independent type of film. They probably just made it on their own. I don't know how Amazon Prime works, or the Amazon Video, they have original content, but is it like a typical studio kind of thing or a Netflix kind of thing where they accept it, or was this something that was pitched, or is it something that was already started by their directors, by the writers of it?
No, Patterson made the movie using money that he had made, using his own money that he made from doing commercials in Oklahoma for the, gosh, what's the baseball team? The Oklahoma, they used to be, that's basketball. I was going to say they used to be the Supersonics. Anyway, he made a bunch of commercials for them and he had the money to make this movie. And then he shopped it to a bunch of film festivals like Slam Dance and Toronto. And that's where Amazon picked it up.
Okay. Yeah. And then the stars of it are kind of unknown. The girl is played by Sierra McCormick, and my kids kept saying, oh, she looks familiar. And I guess she's on was on some of the Disney shows like Jesse.
Did you watch Supernatural, that CW show?
I did. Well, you know, I wasn't a devout every episode watcher, but I watched it over the years, yeah.
Well, there was a season when the big bad of that season was this demon Lilith that was coming back. And there were two episodes where Lilith was a child. And she was played by Sierra McCormick in those two episodes. And then, like, after that, the third episode, they decided to replace the child version of Lilith with a grown woman, probably so that they could kill her. So that there would be less problem with two grown men killing woman playing a demon than a child playing a demon. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Makes it look a little better. But then the other main actor in this movie is Jake Horowitz. And looking at his filmography, I don't recognize him. So yeah, very new actors. The old lady that you talked about is named Gail Kronauer. And she's been very involved in Texas movies. Like reading about her, it's like, oh, she's a very well-known and respected actor in Texas. So, I don't recognize many of the things that she's been in either. That's kind of neat, though, because everybody's kind of unknown and you're not distracted by stardom or casting or anything like that. It's all kind of new and different. So I think that works really well for the film, or at least it did for me. And I thought they did the two main actors, I thought, were very realistic and very authentic, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I really liked the girl. I thought she was exceptional. She seemed so young. They never gave like an age for the character as far as I can remember, but I felt like she was an actual teenager and being told to carry these scenes, I was really impressed. I think she's probably a 20-something, but
the character felt like 16 or something like that. So yeah, Faye is who she played, and then Everett was the male lead. And I think he was supposed to be out of high school and in college, kind of older, probably 18, 19, something like that. And then before we get into the plot or the storyline, the other thing that this movie does is it has the framing or the premise that we are watching an old black and white TV show that's very, 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 very much like The Twilight Zone. And they have the opening scene for it. You're watching this old 50s television set, and it's got the opening sequence for this Paradox Theater, but it's obviously aping The Twilight Zone.
Yeah, it's got like a narrator that sounds like Serling.
Right.
And he says something very similar to what Serling would say about, you know, there is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man, you know, a dimension of imagination, that kind of thing. But I thought that that was really cool, and it would be neat if Patterson made more movies and they would do that in, this is another episode of Paradox Theater.
Yeah, that would be kind of cool. And then, yeah, so that episode starts and it's our movie, and then it goes all the way into the television set, and then it becomes more like the movie. You know, we don't see the TV on the outside. But every once in a while, it goes from the film that we're watching, and it goes back to a grainy black and white, even though it's the same people. And then it kind of pulls out, and you see the TV again. It's just to remind you, I guess, that this is what you're watching. And then it goes back into the TV. And that was kind of neat, too. You would think, well, that obviously pulls you out of the movie. But to me, it seemed more that it did bring you into it more, made it more intimate. And then there were scenes when we're listening. So Everett is the disc jockey or the radio announcer in this town. I get the feeling that he's not the only one, but at this particular day and late night, he's kind of the late night guy on the radio. And this is back in the 1950s in a very small town in New Mexico. So small that everybody in town pretty much is at the high school in the gymnasium watching the high school basketball team play. And so it's the biggest thing in the entire town is packed in to the high school. And it's pretty much these two out in this small town all by themselves. And he's at the radio station. And then she works, like you said, as the switchboard operator at the telephone company.
Well, let me interrupt. This was really fascinating to me, the watching of how she worked the switchboard, where you take the plug, kind of like a microphone plug still looks, and you stick it in a certain hole, and that's a connection between two telephones. And she's got a headset on, and she can hear the conversation. And I guess maybe that's how operators were for a good long time.
Right, yeah. When telephones were new, that was what they had to do.
But watching her do that, and yeah, she's a teenage girl, and it's sort of like her part-time job when the regular operators aren't available. She does it. But there's one part where, like, the switchboard is just going nuts, and she has to answer each one and then connect them with whom they need to talk and then go on to the next one. And I was impressed. I was like, how did people do this? We see it all the time in, like, World War II movies and stuff like that. But it is something that we just take for granted now. But that it was so much work in those days, it looks like.
Yeah, it was all manual, no automatic operator or dial. You know, you dialed the operator. You didn't dial somebody's phone number. You dialed the operator and said, I need to connect to Joan down the road. And then they'd hook you up. And they spent the time, you know, watching her operate that. And you got to know pretty intimately, you know, how she was doing that. And because it was slow like that, you really got a sense of, well, how lonely that job would be. I mean, yeah, you might be able to listen in on conversations around town, but it could be a very lonely thing. It's just one person sitting there in charge of all that. But it could also be very hectic. And then, you know, even the radio station, you know, it's the lone little building with the giant antenna. And it's just him running the radio. And she listens to the radio, because she's friends with Everett, and as she's listening, she hears some strange noises come in.
Hello?
As she's operating the switchboard, she hears that noise coming through on different calls as well, and she thinks it's really strange. And at one point, she calls the radio station and asks Everett, "Are you hearing the same noise that I'm hearing?" And he asks, "Well, when was it?" And she tells him, and he goes back and listens to the tape, and he says, and hears the noise, and he's like, "No, I haven't heard that, not when I was broadcasting." And so there's just a little bit of a mystery there with the noise. And
can you describe the noise for the listeners?
Well, I'll probably play it in audio, but it's a very like a background noise, but it doesn't sound electronic or artificial. It sounds, it's kind of a grinding noise, I guess I would say. Is that how you remember it?
I'm sorry, I don't remember it at all.
Grinding is probably the best description I can think of. But I'll be playing that audio here for the listeners. And I can't remember exactly the sequence of events, but eventually he decides to play it on the air and ask people to call in and see if they hear the noise and what they think it is.
Just like I said it would be. That was Gabe Gunton, followed by Crazy Waves from the Golden Globes. At 718 here at WOTW. Hey, listen up, because we got a quick query for anyone that wants to take a crack. We've got a sound we'd like to play that seems to be sort of bouncing around the valley tonight. We'd like to know your thoughts. We're standing by the phones, and we'd love to know if there's an old expert or ute ham operator we don't know about that's tangling up our antenna. And for the caller who can help us out and can tell us what the sound is, we've got a free piece of Elvis's carpet pulled directly from his floor in Memphis. Lines are open. Please call with any information.
And, you know, she's listening to this. And they get a caller. I believe the caller's name is Billy. And he starts to tell them about when he was in the military. And he was, I can't remember where he was stationed, but he starts telling this story about he was called to go work on this site where it had to be done late at night or whatever, and they had to build something or cover something up. And he had heard that noise there when he was working on that project. And, you know, we've talked about this being a really slow movie, so, you know, as he's describing all this, you're listening to it, and it's almost like you're listening to the radio. They even make that even more known because every once in a while, the entire screen of the movie that you're watching goes black, and you just...
Oh, geez. I thought I had dreamt that, man. there's this... It's during his speech, right? It goes black for like 35 seconds.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
No.
Oh, geez.
No, it goes black for a while. But you're still listening, just like you were listening to the radio. And I'm obviously they did that on purpose to bring you into that feeling of the theater of the mind, like, that we've talked about a lot with why we enjoy audio and podcasting. But it really brings you into that. But it's really bold, I guess, I thought, to do that because... You're watching a movie. You're not listening to the radio. You're there to watch and to see things going on. And the things that you're watching are Faye at the switchboard sitting there listening to the radio. And then you see Everett at the radio station. He might fiddle with the equipment every once in a while, but he's listening to Billy and asking Billy questions and trying to find out more about it. But other than that, you know, it's just listening to this conversation.
Wait, I'm sorry, you're going to have to be clearer. Is this sound a military sound?
That's what we asked this guy at Walker.
And what did he say?
He said it wasn't military. It wasn't military from any country. It was coming from thousands of feet higher than anything could fly.
How did he know that?
Because it was a radar operator.
So were these signals frequent?
No.
And can I ask, I'm assuming this is before Sputnik.
This was years before Sputnik. And signals like yours have been caught going back and forth.
What do you mean?
Like communication. Like one says something over here in this part of the sky, and another says something back. Sometimes they were recorded at Sputnik heights, and sometimes just a few hundred feet off the ground.
Where?
Lots of places. All over.
Well, what do you mean, all over? Billy? Billy, I think we lost you, Billy.
And yeah, I think something happens. Billy gets cut off or something, and then they go to a commercial break, and then Billy comes back. And it just makes it very, you know, you wonder, is Billy alive? Why did he go away? And at some point, she has to bring him something. She's at the switchboard, but she comes to the radio station. Then when Billy gets cut off, she has to go back to the switchboard so not only to get Billy back, but because other people are probably calling, and when she gets there, there's calls that have been waiting for a while, and she has to connect them and everything. But anyway, there's this mystery of what is this sound, and of course, he records it, and she has a little tape recorder. You know, the whole opening sequence is her talking about her tape recorder and talking about things she's read in Popular Mechanics magazine or Popular Science, and anyway... She's kind of an audiophile and has this tape recorder, and he's showing her how to use it and all that kind of thing. And so they have this little tape recorder that they're bringing around. But of course, it's the 1950s, so it's, you know, a microphone with a cord and then pretty good sized little packet with a handle that you would carry around, not just a little micro thing that you would use today. But eventually they both leave. He leaves the radio station and she leaves the switchboard, and they're trying to find things out. I think the old lady who we're talking about, who's Mabel Blanche, I think she calls the radio station, or at least calls Everett on the phone when they're at the switchboard. And she says, "I've heard that noise. I know what it is. I can tell you about it if you come to my house."
Sorry, let me talk for a minute here. Besides being slow, the whole movie is kind of a mystery. And it's well done because the characters are intrigued by what they're hearing. And they want to get to the bottom of it. And those characters are us. And they just run around town. This is a tiny little town. It takes place in a place called Cayuga, New Mexico, which doesn't exist. But Rod Serling's Cayuga Productions made the Twilight Zone. So,
oh, cool.
That tells you something there. But yeah, there's always something ominous about it. And when Billy tells his story, he worked for the military and he was sworn to secrecy to not tell this story anymore. And there were some other people that had their very similar experiences, and they're all dead. So you're just waiting. You're like, oh no. And Billy is kind of vague. He doesn't answer all the questions. So we're waiting to find out what is going on and what made that noise. And so when this woman says, "I know what it is, but you have to come here." Yeah, it was scary, dude. But it's scary in the, I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't think I would go to this place by myself. I mean, it's two people, two young people, but you know what I mean? She's down in the basement of her house and she's in a wheelchair, but we don't know that. It's just, this is the place they are supposed to go. And I didn't know if something was going to be waiting for them there.
Right.
Or they were going to get there and this woman would be dead, or what it was, except for there was suspense in the air of, something is going to happen. And I think that that's a really effective way of telling a story when you have no budget. To have characters come on, or in this case, they're not even there in the room, and tell a story, and you just listen to them tell the story rather than see a depiction, a dramatic depiction of their story. And since you and I are both podcasters, maybe we have a predilection toward this already, especially you with the old time radio
stuff.
Where you'll play that and it's just like, that's what life was, that's what entertainment was before television, is everybody gathered around the radio, and maybe you did close your eyes or maybe you turned off all the lights and you saw in your head what was going on. So in this scene where they go and there's an old lady and she's in a wheelchair and she's facing, we get her profile. The whole time we get her profile, she doesn't face the camera. And so I started to be afraid of what are they not showing us. I started to think, okay, eventually she's going to turn her head and we're going to see like some pulsating thing on her face is controlling her or whatever, because I just didn't know. I didn't know why they weren't cutting away, why they were showing just the side of her face. But she tells this story, and just like with Billy on the radio, it just stops and lets her tell her tale. And it's so tense to do this. It's a very documentary way of telling a story. But even in documentaries, you cut. You remove all the ums and you remove the stammers and the moments when somebody's trying to find their words. And this movie doesn't do that. It's just on this woman like it's really happening, and you can't cut away.
Yeah, every once in a while, you see Faye and Everett, listening to her. I guess it's just to remind us that they're in the room too. But she pretty much tells the story, and I'm not going to get it correct, In fact, I probably shouldn't even try to tell it, but...
Let me see if I can remember. She had a child, right? And the child... did the child have some kind of developmental problem?
Yes.
And what was the deal with the child? Would it... It would hear things that nobody else would, or it would talk to people that weren't there, or what would the child do?
It would talk to people that weren't there, and then it would talk in this strange language.
That's what it was. And she had written down, like, the stuff that the kid had said, right?
Yes, yeah.
And when they first arrive, so they've turned on this tape recorder. When they first arrive, the woman is saying this litany of nonsense language. And it's important because later they have a recording of it.
She raised the child alone because she had the child out of wedlock. The father had left her and the boy at one point. And so she did raise it alone, you know, in this small town, the same town they're in. And of course, you know, so I'm sure there was lots of people talking about her, and she said that she just became numb to that. But yeah, she did learn this language, and eventually her child was taken.
And then when he was 9, I got the feeling that something was out there again. And that night, in the middle of the night, he walked out the front door of this house and vanished.
How?
He was taken up from this earth. There were no other houses. It was very dry. I followed his footprints out the front door, out to about 150 feet, and they stopped there in the dirt. And he wasn't there. They took my son, and no one has ever believed me.
Was there an investigation?
Of course. The whole thing turned to an investigation of me. People were convinced that my son had ruined my life. So I killed him.
She believed that it was aliens, somebody from outer space. And that's kind of where she ends it. And then Everett gets up. He's kind of upset. He doesn't really believe, you know, this lady. He thinks that she's delusional. And... he's kind of like, oh, I can't believe, you know, I fell for this kind of thing. And he gets up and he's gonna leave. And then she stops him and she says, please, wherever you're going, take me with you. He's like, well, why would we take you with us? And she's like, because I want to be with my son again. I want to be taken. And so, and then he just leaves her. I thought, you know, that was a different move than I thought he would, you know, I thought they would think, bring her along or, you know, say, hey, we'll do something, but he just leaves. He's not happy. And I thought that was kind of strange. And, you know, Faye just kind of follows him out. I think she's a little bit taken aback as well, because I think she's more of a believer in everything that's going on. And I think Everett just wants to get to the bottom of it. I can't remember if it was before or after or both, but they do bump into some of their friends at one point. They said, hey, there's lights in the sky outside of town. Have you seen the lights? And they, no, I haven't, you know. And definitely at some point they're in a car with their friends and they're going out to the field or the forest or wherever it is. And they see this big light. And then the driver of the car just kind of zones out and they're going to crash into an oncoming car or off the road or whatever it is. And they don't know quite what happened there, but, you know, he's like, oh, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. And then they're outside of town and they're watching the lights or looking for the lights. And, oh, The other part that I'm forgetting is at some point she goes to her house and gets her little sister because somebody was babysitting the sister and she was talking to her on the phone and then she couldn't get her on the phone anymore. So she was worried about her little sister's baby, you know, her very small toddler. And so then she's carrying around her sister with her wherever they're going. This is after they talk to Mabel. And I guess it's the lights that brings them out to the forest, right?
I don't know. I do remember that she was carrying around this child for such a long time at the end of the movie. And I felt bad for her because that would get really old really quick to having to carry this kid. She doesn't put her down or whatever. She's just still carrying the kid. But yeah, you're right. The driver goes into this trance and nearly wrecks.
Oh, I know what it was. I know it was while they were in the car, he started playing back Mabel speaking the alien words. And that's what sends the driver into a trance, is they're hearing these strange alien words. And then, they're out of town, and something was going on after that alien language was played back. And so Everett and Faye go into the woods, and eventually they find the aliens, right? They find a spaceship out in the middle of the forest, and they start to back away from the spaceship. And then that spaceship joins this humongous mothership. And they're kind of in this clearing because they did run away, but then they're in this clearing. And then all of a sudden the light kind of shines toward them and the wind picks up. You know, it's the three of them, Everett and Faye and her little sister. And then it cuts away from that. And it goes back to the basketball game, or outside the school where the basketball game's being played. And all of the people start coming out of and going to their cars, and they're going to go home and everything, kind of oblivious to what's been going on in town while they've been in the basketball game. And then it cuts back to the clearing in the woods where Everett and Faye were. And they're gone. All you see is, I don't know if it's ash or just the dirt that was underneath them or whatever, but you see their footprints in the sand and you see the tape recorder there, but you don't see them. So essentially they were taken by the aliens, just as Mabel had claimed would happen. And I'm remembering also that Mabel, her theory was that the aliens picked isolated communities like theirs to take people, and they waited until the town was distracted by something, which they were with this basketball game that was going on. And so, and that's pretty much the end of the movie. I don't know if the tape recorder was intact or was it destroyed at the end of that. Is there ever going to be a record of what Everett and Faye were trying to figure out with these noises and the language?
I think that, the tape recorder was still there and it was still recording, so that somebody somewhere would play it back and say, you know, something was going on here.
I'm looking at the movie right now.
Oh, you're watching it?
So yeah, it shows their footprints and it shows like a bunch of ash on the ground. And it shows the tape recorder kind of on a mound of ash. So now, boy, I didn't catch that, I guess, when I first watched the movie. So does that mean they were vaporized, or does that mean they were taken? I had just assumed that they had been taken by the mothership.
But it's definitely ash, huh?
Yeah, it looks like it. So I don't know. I guess we'll...
So it's open to your interpretation whether the aliens felt like they got too close and had to be exterminated, or whether they went up into the ship with whoever else they took.
So yeah, sorry we got a little jumbled up there at the end, but hopefully you get the sense of what this movie was like and kind of the tone of it. I really enjoyed the movie quite a bit. I think it's just, you know, because it's, you know, my kind of thing with the audio and the old time and the small town and the, you know, trying to get all the evidence and talk to different people. And I kind of thought the longer takes and the non-action-y aspect of the movie was kind of refreshing. I kind of enjoyed that. Even though, like we were talking about earlier, I kept expecting something to happen. I kept expecting toward the end, you know, there would be a turning point where we'd see something scuttle away. I don't know if we'd ever see the aliens, but, you know, I thought there'd be a lot more action toward the end. But there really wasn't. It kind of kept that same tone all the way through. And this was quiet. It was just focused on the two people. And it took its time telling the story. And it didn't shirk from just letting the story be told, just as it would if it was in real life. You know, if Billy was calling into the radio station talking about all this stuff, that's how it would go down. It wouldn't be quick takes and firing questions quickly at them. And then the same kind of thing with Mabel. That's something that I've always appreciated in older movies like It's a Wonderful Life. If It's a Wonderful Life was ever reproduced, which it shouldn't be, but if it was ever rebooted in a movie today, they would never spend that much time talking about George Bailey as a little kid and George Bailey as when he first started the savings and loan and all the, the whole movie builds up to the thing with the angel at the end, but man, it takes a long time to get there. And there's a lot of stuff in there. You wouldn't see that in a movie today. It would be very, here's a quick little 5-minute montage of George Bailey as a young boy. And it would step through that a lot quicker, I would think. And it wouldn't want to take the time like the movie does. The original movie. And so I kind of got that feel from this as well. And, you know, even though my kids commented on it, they enjoyed the movie too. Everybody kind of liked it. They were questioning, you know, what was going on when they were in the woods and stuff like that. But they said they liked it. So that was nice too.
Well, that surprises me. I don't think that the movie is for everybody, and it's, you know, it's definitely slow. Kids have even smaller attention spans than we do, than our MTV generation does. And so it impresses me that they'd respond to it. And I wonder if, what was his name, Montague? What's the director's name?
Andrew Patterson.
Well, I wonder if Patterson gets offers. Like, I mean, surely has to happen. Somebody in Hollywood's going to come calling and say, hey, make a movie, you know, for us for $3 million. If he'll make a more traditionally paced and directed film once he has the money. And it was really just by necessity that he did this movie this way. Or if it's just a stylistic choice and he will continue to do things like that. We've seen many indie directors who hit it big, and you go back and you watch their first movie, and a lot of times you can see who they were, even in the, for example, Duel with Steven Spielberg. We talk about that all the time. It's like the Steven Spielberg that we know today is all over Duel.
Yeah.
Like I've seen Christopher Nolan's first movie, Following, and Memento, you know, those first couple movies. And it's the same Christopher Nolan that we know today. So that sort of thing will be interesting to watch. Surely people have taken note of this movie and said, oh, let's give this guy a bigger canvas and see what he can create. I mean, I'm assuming that's the point of making a movie like this.
It's interesting. You mentioned Montag earlier. So it looks like Andrew Patterson is the director, and then in his writer's credit, he goes by James Montag.
Okay.
And then the other writer was Craig Sanger. So that's interesting.
But why? Why do you come up with a pseudonym for yourself as the writer? Is there a benefit to, I don't know, to people thinking that a different person wrote it than directed it? Wouldn't it be more of a showcase if it's written and directed by you?
Yeah, I would think that would mean more than being known as distinctly as a writer versus a director. That's kind of interesting that he would do that. We'll have to ask him, I guess.
Okay, yeah, just get him on the phone. I know it's kind of late, but he'll pick up.
Yeah.
Anyway, the fact that both of us saw this movie, and I think when I first heard of it, it's somebody on Facebook, one of those people that's super socially active on social media, there's a difference, that posts like every movie that they see. And so there'll be multiple posts a day sometimes, like on weekends. They had posted this, and then they'll put like a little blurb in the comments of what they thought of the movie. And that was the first I had heard of it. And I think what intrigued me was that he mentioned in his little mini review that it was presented as though it were an episode of The Twilight Zone. So I did some research and, you know, watched the trailer. It was available on YouTube. And that, and then I asked my cousin if he would be interested in watching the movie, and he wasn't. He said, no, it looks boring. And I understand getting that impression from the trailer that they try and sell the movie as best they can in the trailer, but there's, you know, there's not a lot of explosions that you can show in that trailer. And then...
Yeah.
Then you and I had talked about doing it on the show, and so I told him, well, I'm going to watch it no matter what, except I don't have Amazon Prime. So... The only way I can watch it is if Marshall hooks me up or we watch it together. And so my cousin was like, oh, okay, yeah, we'll watch it together. And then I slept through it. So,
well, I guess even though you slept through it and you were tired when you watched it, I guess what is your take on it? Did you enjoy watching it or was it a little too slow?
I did think it was a little too slow, but I appreciated the things that he was able to pull off. Like there is that spectacular shot at the very, very beginning, which it doesn't have any point to it narratively, except for we're meeting these two characters and finding out their relationship, but it goes on and on and on and on. And the only reason for that is to show what this guy is capable of as a director in a single take. Because at one point he goes into the basketball, the gymnasium, I guess, where they're playing in a single shot. And it's followed them through like the parking lot and talking to people in cars and testing out the tape recorder and talking about the technology. And we sort of get the impression that the girl is sweet on the boy. But I don't know. There's not much romance that goes on in the movie, unless I slept through that bit too. But then, you know, we get to see the basketball team playing and all this, and I just, that is really impressive, because that's so hard to do, especially when it's not a Hollywood production with a bunch of professionals or professional extras and all this stuff and tons of wranglers and ADs that are going to get everybody to wait the 8 minutes while you're shooting all your stuff outside. And then it's like, okay, here they come, ready, start playing your basketball game. And that, and just, I don't really know how you could pull something off like that in a single take. So I was more impressed by the technical aspect of it and the fact that with no money, they made me like lean in toward the television and try and figure out what was going on. Because it shouldn't have worked. Billy talking for, let's say it was only 5 minutes, but I'll bet it was closer to 10, telling his story, and you never see Billy once. We've no idea who he is. We just hear his voice. That shouldn't work. It should be death for a narrative. You should feel restless and be like, okay, why are we watching this? You know, but it works. It draws you in, and your curiosity is piqued. Anyhow, I think that this is a very talented filmmaker, and I will be watching to see what he makes next. If people continue to make movies, it's up in the air now.
Yeah. Or if everything is meant for a streaming audience at this point. But I thought this did work well. I mean, I probably would have enjoyed it in a theater as well. But I thought it worked really well just watching it in the living room, you know, with my family and that kind of thing. Maybe I oversold my kids' enjoyment of it. I mean, you know, they said they liked it and they didn't complain about watching it, but they weren't like, oh, that was the greatest movie ever. But they talked a little bit about it afterwards. And like I said, weren't complaining about it the whole time. We're like, oh, I can't believe we had sat through that whole thing.
Well, yeah, I wonder what it would be like to see this in a theater, because your focus is 100% on the story in that case. And we don't allow the kids to make snarky comments throughout the whole movie, unless it's Mystery Science Theater 3000. So you're just sort of forced to be silent and follow the narrative of the film. I've no idea what that would be like. Almost every movie is better on the big screen. The few exceptions, and this is something that you can cut out, but I know you won't. We were talking this week about what's your least favorite genre of film. And I didn't right. know what to put for my least favorite genre. So I put Jane Austen adaptations. But you beat me because you put found footage films.
Yeah.
And I loathe found footage films, because it's so, so hard to make the audience suspend their disbelief, or to make me suspend my disbelief, I guess, because I just know too much about how movies are made and how stories are told. And like every single time they cut or characters bring up their camera to focus on something when you wouldn't do it in real life, it takes me out of the movie. And I did see Blair Witch Project in 1999 in the theater, and I hated it. I absolutely hated it. But my sister really liked it, and she told my mom, we've got to go see this movie together. And she told my mom that it was real. You know what I mean?
Oh, no.
That they had found these tapes and put them all together or whatever. And my mom was just like sick through the whole movie. She just couldn't handle like the camera, the handheld camera for an hour and a half kind of thing. And she said it was like the most miserable experience she had ever had seeing a movie. And I remember being physically sick when I saw Bourne Ultimatum. Oh. And I had to just close my eyes and ask my friend to tell me what was going on in the movie. But later, it was on and I watched a few minutes of it on television and I didn't get motion sick at all. So I guess the point with that super long diatribe was, I hate found footage films. No, it's not all movies are better in the theater, but I feel like most are. And I don't know. I mean, we're in a world right now where most of the movie theaters are still closed, so you can't go see things. But I'm in one of those towns where there's a mom and pop theater and they have to be open, or because they're still paying their lease every month on the property, and they would rather sell tickets at 20% capacity than zero, because it still costs them the same. And so I've tried to go to some of these mom and pop theaters, and like we talked about when we did our, I think it was the Hercules episode, it's the chance to see all these retro, these catalog titles, these old movies, older movies or whatever. And it has been such a joy to be able to go and see these things. And I wish that it were really old movies. Like, I'd love to be able to see Treasure of the Sierra Madre or Casablanca or something in the theater.
That'd be great, yeah.
But so far, it's all been like 80s stuff or 90s stuff and big blockbusters that they know have a huge following. And so, yes, I didn't get to see this in the theater, and I don't imagine anybody did unless they were at one of the film festivals that it played at. But, you know, streaming has its place, and maybe that's the future of how most people will watch movies. You know, lots of times you'll hear people talk about a TV show, and they're just waiting until they can stream it and binge the whole thing, because that's how people prefer to watch things nowadays. But I don't think movie theaters will ever go away, because it's this communal experience, this experience of strangers coming together in the dark and sharing something that is just different than you can do it on your phone, or you can do it on your computer, or you can do it on your television. Again, if you choose to cut all this out, half of the episode is gone.
No, I'm with you. I really like the theater going experience. You know, horror movies are more gripping and horrific, I guess, you know, depending on the type of horror or whatever. But
no, they absolutely are. Even the kind with the jump scares, the stupid jump scares, you get to hear the people around you react and say, oh, they got me on that. Or, oh, you jumped. Oh, I saw you. And just like, ha ha. And there's something awesome about that, of hearing strangers scream and then laugh after they screamed.
Yeah, and then, you know, with laughing, you know, comedies too. I mean, laughing at something in the theater is a lot more fun, and I would laugh more than if I was just sitting in my living room watching it. You know, I might chuckle or smile or you know, sometimes I'll laugh out loud when I'm watching something on TV, but not as much as I would if I were in the theater. And, you know, just hearing little kids say funny things is fun. And sometimes I'll, you know, when I'm watching like the premiere of a Star Wars movie or an Avengers movie or something, sometimes I think people get a little carried away and I might roll my eyes a little bit. But, you know, watching The Force Awakens when the Millennium Falcon shows up and everybody just cheers, that's great. You know, that's a lot of fun to be part of that. So, yeah, I really like the theater experience as well. And I'm finally going to join you, not physically, but this Saturday, we're going to go see Jaws in a theater. So I think that'll be a lot of fun.
Oh, that's great. And do you have anybody that you can take that hasn't seen Jaws?
No, my oldest son hasn't seen it. But he doesn't want to see it. He's not a big horror fan, especially something like Jaws. But I'd like to take him to it, but he doesn't want to go. And then the rest of my kids have seen it. My wife's seen it. But, you know, they're playing a lot of things like Back to the Future and Jurassic Park and Goonies and that kind of thing. I don't know if they played anything locally, but I missed The Empire Strikes Back. I heard you got to go see it, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's the last movie I saw, and we'll have to talk about it on our Delusions of Grandeur episode, because I enjoyed it as much in 2020 as I did the very first time I saw it in, I'm going to say 84, but I mean, it could even have been 85 when it came out on video. It's for its 40th anniversary, and I wouldn't be surprised if it plays the whole summer. So hopefully you'll get another chance to see it. And it's the 2004 version, which I think is better than the 1997 version. But nothing is better than the 1980 version.
Right.
So it would be fun if you were able to get to see it, and we could do an episode about it. But even if you weren't, we're still going to do an episode about it.
so there you have it, kids. We've talked about The Vast of Night and many other things. Hopefully you've enjoyed this and were able to follow it. Hopefully you're able to watch the movie before listening to us talk about it. So You may have been screaming at your iPhone while you were listening to us, but it's a lot of fun to talk about these movies, whether they're good or whether they're bad. And hopefully we'll be able to continue to bring these episodes to you for a long time. If you'd like to hear us talk about a specific movie, feel free to send us an email at journeyintopodcast@gmail.com, or to go to Facebook or Twitter and look up Journey Into and suggest movies to us. For the purposes of this podcast, I put the limit at PG-13. So if you have anything that's PG-13 or below that you'd like us to watch, feel free to let us know. There's also a Patreon for the Journey Into podcast. As you're listening to this, this episode has been on the Patreon for several weeks. So you could have heard this earlier if you were only a Patreon member. And if you want to check that out, you can go to patreon.com/journeyinto and check out the different things that I have there. For only $1 a month, you can get extra stuff and early releases of the podcast. I'm always looking to see what else I can bring to the Patreon listeners, even more than what's here on the podcast. And Rish, you have a Patreon as well. Would you like to tell us about that one?
You mean just give the address or tell us what the Patreon...
Or both. Or you can give it a little plug.
Yeah, it's www.patreon.com/Rish Outfield. I try and put stuff up there every week. Stuff that the people who support me get for free. And I do charge you for episodes of the Rish Outcast, which is my solo podcast. But just like supporting Marshall, you get an address every single month. And Marshall, I've noticed yours have started getting bigger and bigger and bigger too.
Yeah,
we both intended for them just to be like, hey guys, I'm checking in. Just thanks for supporting me. Here's what you can look forward to this month. But they've started to become bigger. And whatever is going on in our world we talk about, it's become really interesting. I super enjoy listening to your Patreon addresses. And I hope that people enjoy listening to mine, because it's like getting a bonus episode every month. We talk about what we're working on as writers, what we're working on as podcasters, and you know what's on our mind, what's going on in the world. So if you enjoy this show, my guess is you would enjoy supporting either or both of us over on Patreon.
Yeah, I definitely enjoy the stuff there. I just listened to your latest episode of the Twilight Groan, where you and your niece talk about different episodes of the Twilight Zone. And I enjoy that quite a bit. I've even, if I get a hint of what you're going to do next, I'll even watch the episode before listening to that. So yeah, more stuff on Rish's podcast as well. So,
do you find that you appreciate our conversation more if you've seen the episode, or is it more rewarding to have no idea what we're talking about and then go watch the episode after?
It's kind of fun both ways. This last time I had watched the episode with the doppelgangers, and I wouldn't have remembered that one. You know, some of the classic episodes that you guys have talked about, like, you know, the monsters of Maple Street and things like that, I already kind of know, but it's kind of interesting to hear Cathex's take on that. Yeah, I think both ways works pretty well.
Well, I'm glad, and we do have more of those coming. Yeah, I mean, it's funny that we're talking about the Twilight Zone, and Vast of Night was so influenced by the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, for sure. It goes together.
They do.
Well, that's enough plugs from us, I guess, but we do enjoy hearing from the people that listen to this podcast, and we would love to hear your suggestions and your thoughts about these movies that we're talking about. So please feel free to reach out to us. Other than that, The Vast of Night has come here as well, so it's probably time to bid you all adieu. have a good night out there in the vast of night.
Yeah, always watch the skies, as they said in a totally different alien invasion movie.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
So we were all working on this big project. I remember the most important thing was to protect the integrity of this podcast. I only worked on part of it, but it was part of a bigger thing. I think I heard one of the captains talk about the Creative Commons license, but I wasn't sure what that meant. I just knew the thing that I worked on was attribution part, which meant that if somebody played part of this podcast, they'd have to tell people where it came from, what the source was. One of the guys I talked to said he worked on something called No Derivative. He said that had something to do with that nobody could change the content of the audio. And he told me that he talked to somebody that was working on something called the non-commercial part of this Creative Commons project. And that meant that nobody could profit from playing this podcast. I don't know, we never worked together, we never could quite put it all together, but I know the most important thing to the military, to the government, was that this podcast could be shared with as many people as possible without it being exploited and used for evil purposes. That's about all I know. I tried to dig deeper, but people started disappearing. What do you mean, disappearing? Well, that's just what I... Billy? Billy, are you there? I think I lost Billy.
And the thing I think I want you guys to know about this movie is from its earliest thought, 5 or 6 years ago, it was always supposed to be a movie that did two things. One was it took genre seriously, and it took it seriously in a way that you aren't used to maybe seeing the characters and the performances and the story take a story like this seriously. And the second thing was for it to push the boundaries of storytelling somehow. And so we looked for ways to kind of blend things that maybe didn't necessarily always fit into the box of something that was sci-fi or something that was low budget or something that was a period film. And so hopefully all that amalgamation adds up to something and you guys have a spectacular night.